Yeah. So please, but without further ado, please step up.
Well, needless to say, there are no quotes from the Bible in my novel, which is entitled Money Shot. And yes, it is about the adult film industry. Coming back from the dead isn't as easy as they make it seem in the movies. In real life, it takes forever to do little things like pry open your eyes, to spend excruciating ages trying to bend your left middle finger down far enough to feel the rope around your wrist, even longer figuring out that that cold, hard thing poking you in the cheek is one of the handles on a pair of jumper cables. This is not the kind of action that makes for gripping cinema. Plus, there are these long, dull stretches where people in the audience would probably go take a piss or get popcorn, since it looks like nothing is happening, and they figure maybe you really are dead after all. After a while, you start to wonder the same thing yourself. You also wonder what will happen if you throw up behind the oily rag duct taped into your mouth, or how long it will take somebody to notice that you're missing. Otherwise, you're mostly busy bleeding, trying not to pass back out, or laboriously adding up the cables, the stuffy, cramped darkness, the scratchy carpet below, and the raw, hollow metal above to equal your current location, the trunk of an old and badly maintained car. That's what it was like for me, anyway. I'm sure you're wondering what a nice girl like me was doing left for dead in the trunk of a piece of shit Honda Civic out in the industrial wasteland east of downtown Los Angeles. Or maybe we've met before, and you're wondering why it hadn't happened sooner.
So how was that as a good appetizer for
a little dim sum?
Yeah, that's right. Okay. Okay. I wanted to introduce our two conversationalists for today. I think all of you probably know Dick Lotke. A consummate book reviewer. His reviews have appeared, probably you have seen them in the LA Times. He's also a mystery writer. He had his first, it's your first novel, right? Sleeping Dogs, that was nominated for an Edgar. And I believe we have one for sale over there. And in terms, you asked a lot of people, the board members, about Dick. You know, some people say, well, if Dick Lotke's there, I got to come to this program. So thank you so much for coming here. And Dick will be interviewing Judith Freeman. And Judith Freeman has authored a number of books, short stories, Family Attractions, is that your collection? And other novels, Chinchilla Farm, Set for Life, The Desert of Pure Feeling, and her novel, Red Water, which was about, that was set in, is it 19th century Utah, was on the list of one of the 100 best novels in 2002 by the LA Times. She's here, of course, for a completely different novel, or I shouldn't call novel. You could, that may be part of your conversation, I don't know. But this book, The Long Embrace, Raymond Chandler and the Woman He Loved. And it's a wonderful book. I've read it. And it's a very interesting approach to writing about Raymond Chandler and his wife, Sissy. And it's also, I think, kind of a memoir about Judith to some extent as well. And I'm sure they'll be going into her approach to this book. And this is very appropriate. Actually, we had asked Judith in December to come to speak to us in January. And what happened was, her reply to me got stuck in my spam folder. Had no idea she had agreed. And we had went ahead and scheduled something else. But Judith was so gracious to agree to come this week. And it's so appropriate because what's happening on this Wednesday, March 25th. Anybody?
Second coming.
Yeah. It's the 50th anniversary of Raymond Chandler's death. And actually, if you look on the LA Times blog, they're doing some wonderful things. They're taking old clippings about Raymond Chandler and some book reviews of his work and putting it there, so I would check it out. So I think it's, and Judith herself will be participating in a program. She teaches at USC, and at USC, right? Yeah, this Wednesday. So anyway, without further ado, a conversation with Dick Block-Tiki and Judith Freeman. Thank you for coming.
First, I want to say this is the first time that I've ever sat on a chair where I could dangle my feet.
I'm afraid my shoes are going to fall off.
It's
not
an interesting approach to have not just to have a lectern in front of us, but to be sitting here on these chairs. But anyhow, we progress because we can get into this thing.
Right.
When did you develop your fondness for Raymond Chandler?
Obsession?
Well, I didn't want to get that far into it, but what started you off on it?
1980s, a friend of mine introduced me to Raymond Chandler's novels, and I thought they were so original, so interesting, such an incredibly distinctive American voice. And then I read his letters, and I thought, what a smart guy, what an amazing thinker, and I became interested in Chandler's life. Then I became interested in his marriage. I already had a deep interest in L.A., and I began making a list of all the addresses at the top of the letters and noticed that he had lived in over 36 different places in and around Los Angeles. And at that time I said, I'm going to track down every place where Raymond Chandler ever lived, and I'm going to photograph what I found. And then I got caught up writing other books and novels, and it wasn't until 2003 that I said, I never lost the interest in this idea. And I said, I'm going to now really write my Raymond Chandler book. And I knew that I would be thinking about his novels, but also a lot about his life and his marriage, because I felt that that marriage was very important.
So you didn't start out with the idea of delving into Sissy's life or Sissy Pascal's life. This was something that came about after you decided to write about Raymond Chandler.
Right. It really started first with Chandler, and what an interesting, extraordinarily beautiful writer he was. He did so many things for the mystery novel. He imbued it with a sense of atmosphere that was so thick, so rich. And then I just felt like there are few writers that have been so indelibly connected with place. You can think of Balzac in Paris or Dickens in London. And here's Chandler in L.A. And he gave L.A. a lasting identity. And I think it still is affected by the perceptions that Chandler disseminated about this city.
Is it the sense of place that made you decide that one of the ways you were going to go about this would be to visit the however many houses he lived in L.A.? I mean, was that what triggered your modus operandi?
Right. I think also that, when we write a book, we're trying to figure out how do you structure a novel or how do you structure a book? And I saw that in this idea of tracking down all of these different Chandler residences, that in fact it would give me a quest. It would give me a kind of structure to the book, and the structure would be tied into looking for these different addresses. And I never knew what I was going to find, and it would also replicate a kind of activity of a detective. I was on my own search, and yes, I think that came first, this idea that people say L.A. is so hard to get. It's such an amorphous, strange, horizontal, unfathomable, complex city. And when people come to it with a big idea and try to force it into that idea, I don't think it fits. I don't think you get it. I think it's so slippery and so extraordinary. But if you look at it incrementally,
if you look at a lot of small little pieces, I think a reader can begin to put together a pattern for themselves, begin to get a sense of the city. And I had people tell me after the book was published, I've never gotten Los Angeles. I've never understood it. And I feel like I understand it more after reading your book. And I think that was a kind of byproduct. It maybe wasn't the first goal I had. But I think by looking at all of these neighborhoods and thinking about Chandler, the way he wrote about the city, that it did start to make a certain picture of the place.
The thing that strikes me about using that approach is that Chandler's novels especially seem to be like little bits and pieces put together too, which form an interesting whole, but almost that the pieces are more interesting than they than what you finally wind up with.
That's interesting, because two things about that. One is, he said he was always lousy on crowd scenes. He could never write big crowd scenes, but give him two people snotting at each other over a desk and he was a happy man. So he liked these little scenes, and you see that happening over and over again in Chandler, these pieces. The other thing was, as many of you probably know, he liked to cut these yellow sheets that he wrote on in half, and he would write on half sheets in the typewriter, roll them in a half sheet at a time, because he said he had to have something happen on every one of those half sheets. And so you see him cutting up even the paper is so small bit, wanting something to happen on every half sheet. And yes, Chandler's books are kind of cobbled together, but they also have this great sense of driving in them. Marlowe was always driving. Mm-hmm. You know, people are, you know, he really figured out, obviously, that L.A. was about driving. And Marlowe was always getting in his car and going somewhere.
Going to the various places that you went to, and I have to say that in reading some of the things you did to get inside of buildings, you know, my toes were crawling up, you know, I just couldn't imagine anybody actually, you know, looking in people's windows and then being caught at it, you know, and looking around and trying to pretend that you just, you know, just happen to be in the neighborhood. But do you think that the fact that Chandler moved around so much is how he became so cognizant whatever was going on in L.A.? I mean, was that...
I do. I think one of the reasons he got the city so well was because he literally lived all over the map. And
he'd live in like three... He'd move three times in the course of a year. Right?
Yeah. He would live for a few months in an apartment, always renting... rented apartments. His wife was 18 years older than he was, as many of you know. And they became rather reclusive as she began to age. They had few friends. They had, you know, no family, no children, no social life. They just had a cat and each other. And they were constantly moving. And with a car, you could do that. And they would go to Big Bear for the summer where it was cool, and, you know, Cathedral City in the winter, and they would try Santa Monica and it was damp, and they would move to Silver Lake, and they'd go to Arcadia and Monrovia. But you see it in a book, for instance, like The Little Sister, that great sweep of geography, the L.A. basin, where you go from Big Bear, Lake Arrowhead, down into San Bernardino, into Riverside, to Hollywood, all the way to Santa Monica. And, you know, it happens several times in the course of the book. You've got this great, you know, sweep of geography, which was essentially Chandler's life, how he lived, moving all those places, living in so many different areas. And it gave him not only a feeling for the city, but it gave him a feeling for different classes of people within the city. And he had worked, of course, for Dabney Oil Company, for a very wealthy guy named Joseph Dabney, who lived in a mansion on Lafayette Park. And he knew that class. That's where Mrs. Murdoch and the High Window comes from, and General Sternwood. And yet, you know, on the other end of it, little, seedy, hairy, you know, and all of the kind of low life, the gentleman gangsters, the little secretaries from the Midwest. He knew those people because he had worked in the business community in the 20s. He'd met those secretaries from the Midwest. He knew those wildcatters out in the oil fields. He understood their slang. He hung out in bars. He was on the fringe of Hollywood and then, you know, of course, in the middle of it. So he captured that sense of L.A. being this great melting pot. Lots of different kinds of people ending up
here. You mentioned Cathedral City. One of the interesting things in your book, I think, is that you seem to be channeling Chandler in writing the descriptions and everything. And one that I copied down from, you were talking about a Cathedral City, a deserted disco that had all the charm of a used condo. Exactly the kind of thing that Chandler would have used to describe that. Were you conscious of doing that when you, or was it just something that you were in the Chandler zone, you know?
I think I was in the Chandler zone. I never said, I'm going to try and write like Chandler. It would have never occurred to me. It would have seemed quite an ill-fated idea. I never thought about that. But what happened is that I was reading so much Chandler at the time. It was as though by osmosis. He began to seep into my brain, and I'm sure, but I have to say it was largely unconscious, but the funny thing about that particular moment was that I was reading James Ellroy's My Dark Places, and I've never read James Ellroy's fiction, but I was reading James Ellroy's My Dark Places, and he was seeping into me, and I began to feel Ellroy taking me over.
It's pretty scary.
A little bit. Really scary. And that, I didn't resist. Mm-hmm. That, I could feel, and I thought, let it go. And that was the moment when I was writing that particular section. So in an odd way, it was like me channeling Ellroy, channeling Chandler, you know, coming back to me. I was much more aware just at that moment of Ellroy than Chandler.
I don't think Ellroy likes Chandler very much.
I don't think he does either, and I find that interesting. I mean, I've never had a conversation with him about it, but people who have say that the reason he doesn't like Chandler is that he finds the whole idea of, you know, the white knight hero so faked up. You know, he loves the idea of the private eye, the cop, who's sleazier than any criminal that he might be pursuing, because somehow that fits with what interests him are the really rotten cops, the sleazy people. So a guy like Philip Marlowe, who really does embody a moral code that is so strict and so strong, he is so completely incorruptible, Marlowe. It's the opposite, I think, of the Cowboy. He wants to go into that seedy, seedy, really underbelly and say they're all the same. I mean,
it's all good, though. I mean, if you're into the mystery field, there's no reason why you can't say both of them are okay. I mean, I don't understand when people knock a writer because they're not writing the kind of book I want to write.
Yeah.
It's like the Chandler movie, the Long Goodbye. Right. People hate the movie, but yet it's not a bad movie. It's just a bad Chandler movie, but it's a pretty good movie, actually.
Yeah. Well, you might also, I mean, you know, Ellroy's wonderful because he has such an outsized sense of himself. If anyone has ever seen an interview, you know, he's the greatest, he's the best, he's the finest, you know, he's everything. But maybe you have to kill off the father figure, the original, best, greatest, most brilliant, in order, you know, you slay the father so that the son can be.
Slay that original demon dog of the American right, so that you can become the demon dog.
That's right.
So how long did it take you to research and do this book? When did you start on it? And what are the various stages that you went through on it?
It took about 3 years, really, to write it. And it was my first nonfiction book, and it's not a novel, even though NPR listed it as one of the 5 best mystery novels of last year.
But you'll take that, right?
I'll take that.
Sure.
But it really is nonfiction. But it also is the kind of book that crosses a lot of borders of genres. What Naomi said is true, that it is a portrait of me, as much as it's a portrait of Chandler, as much as it's a portrait of a marriage, a writer, a city, the kind of travel log. But I started to write it as fiction, and my editor didn't like it. And he was absolutely right. It wasn't any good. And I was researching Chandler at the UCLA Special Collections has one of Chandler's archives. The Bodleian Library at Oxford has the other archive. And I was working there, and I gave a talk called The Real Long Goodbye, lousy title. But the talk was 23 pages, and when I looked at it, and it was really about Chandler's marriage to Sissy, all of their moods, how she, I felt, had affected his life and his writing. It was a very poignant story of a marriage. They were married for 30 years. They were deeply committed, even though, yes, he did have affairs. They were reclusive. They were blah, blah, blah. And when I saw that talk, I said, that's the book. I looked at those 23 pages, and I sent it to my editor at Pantheon, and I said, this is the book I want to write. It's a nonfiction book. And he took it to the people at Pantheon, and they said, we don't think she can do it, because Sissy is an enigma. Before Chandler died, he burned all of her letters, all of his letters to her. There were no notebooks, there were no writings. The two biographies by Tom Heine and Frank McShane had basically said she's an enigma. Nobody can know her. So I just kept pushing and saying, but I think I can see her. I can see her all over the place. I can see references to her in the letters. I can see her in the fiction. And I bet if I got into those archives that I would be looking for things that those guy biographers weren't even interested in. And wouldn't it be interesting anyway to write a book about the search? Even if I never found her, couldn't I make an interesting book about the search for Sissy Chandler? And finally, I just, you know, convinced him, and he gave me an advance, and I went on with him 2 years. In the archives of Bodleian, spent a month going through the 82 boxes. And I did find a lot of material that people hadn't bothered me. And I think that some of it was really important.
Well, I was interested in why the Bodleian seemed to have more stuck with her signatures on it than the UCLA one did. What was the breakdown there? Do you have any idea?
Yeah, that, you know, UCLA has 12 boxes. The Bodleian has 82 boxes. Before Chandler died in 58, he was dumping stuff. He was dumping scripts and manuscripts, and he was in a deeply lonely and alcoholic phase of his life. Since he had died in 54, he was so unhappy. He was just, he was moving around. He didn't have a permanent home. And a librarian at UCLA wrote to him and said, don't throw that stuff away. We want it. And started getting it from Chandler. And then Chandler died. And Helga Green, his literary agent in London, had by then become very involved in Chandler's life, and she got so much more material that she had begun accumulating. And what Chandler left in boxes when he died, when it was cleaned out, went to Helga Green, not to UCLA. So there were many photographs and letters and manuscripts and documents, as well as, for instance, Sissy's recipe box, which Chandler kept because he was interested in cooking. And at the end of his life, he was going to write a book called Cooking for Idiots. and it was going to be, you know, Chandler on Simple Recipes, and, you know, it was Helga's way to work with him to try and help him have something to do as well.
He could have just started that whole Idiots book.
Yeah, he could have made more money off that than So that's why Moore ended up there at the bottom end, because at his death, just Helga brought a lot of that stuff there.
So when you're going through this whole deal of like trying to piece together whatever you could of Sissy's life, what do you think was what surprised you the most by what you found?
I think what surprised me was we all know that Marlowe was created as a white knight. You see that at the beginning, and it's a big sleep when he's entering the Sternwood mansion, and he looks up and he sees the stained glass window with the knight, and he thinks he's doing a lousy job saving the woman, and he said he wasn't trying. You know, he would try, Marlowe. And it's just, you know, people have always pointed this out, the connection between Marlowe and the idea of the white knight. One of the things I found was that Sissy had given him a nickname of Galabion. You can hardly pronounce it. I mean, for a nickname. She called him Romeo because he was so romantic. But she also called him Galabion. And there are photographs of them before they're even married. Him in Golden Gate Park in 1920, and she says Galabion in Golden Gate Park. In her recipe book, she has applesauce for Galabion. She has notes to him, you know, to Galabion. And it's a made-up name, but it's obviously taken from the Old English. And the E-O, the Bioth, what it really comes down to is perpetual shining night is a kind of way to decode that word, even though it's a made-up name. And it's one that Chandler probably applied to himself, got her to adopt. And when I found that name as a nickname that she was using for him, I thought, my God, that idea of Marlowe really was Chandler's idea of himself. And not only that, she reinforced that by using this nickname for him. And it really made me realize that she had in part helped create that idea of Marlowe as the white man. I think realizing, looking at the nature of their life, I realized how terribly lonely Chandler really was. And you see that in Marlowe, a kind of endemic, incurable, deep, chronic loneliness that to me is part of what makes his book so existential and so modern. He captured that feeling in Los Angeles that I think is still here for many of us. It's a very hard place to make connections. And I think that he and Sissy in their own way had a haunting kind of loneliness about them. So, I mean, I was coming across things like that. I was surprised that, again, no male biographer had ever picked up that name, which was there to find Galabion. I was surprised because there had never been a picture of Chandler and Sissy together. I'd never seen a published photograph of the two of them. And I didn't think any existed. And then one day I was opening a file of photographs, and there it was. And it was a picture that had to be taken as a passport photo, a dual portrait of them, to get back into New York when they took their only trip together in 1952 to London. And by then, Sissy was quite sick. She was 82. Chandler was 64. And here's this picture showing her. I'd always wanted to see a picture of what she looked like at the end of her life when he was still really very much in love with her. And she's still very beautiful. I mean, it's in my book. There are 45 photographs in the book. And that's one of the photographs that I used, is this picture that shows the two of them together. And I think it speaks volumes. Chandler is the one who looks crabby and sour. By that time, they've been through hell on that trip. And Sissy is the one who looks, you know, there's a kindness and a generosity and a beauty that you can still see in her that helps me understand that she was the one who really kept Raymond Chandler sane for so many years, through so many ins and outs, I mean, and ups and downs. And when she died in 54, he lived five more years, but they were five really pretty sad years. He was pretty lost with that.
Well, he tried to kill himself shortly after her death, right?
Right. What he called the world's most inept suicide. Yeah.
I think he phoned the chief of police first and said he was going to do it. And then he went into the shower and shot the ceiling of the shower. But it strikes me throughout the latter part of your book of really what a depressing, awful life both of them had. And, you know, you can only compare it to Hammett and Hellman, I guess, although I gather from a lot of the stuff that you read about them is that their romance wasn't quite as better, or at least they weren't as tight a couple as Chandler.
Oh, I think there were terrible arguments. And I think Lillian Hellman also was an intellectual, a writer in her own right. I think, there was a lot of strife in that marriage. I don't sense that in Chandler's marriage. He was so romantic. He said he had to court her every day of his life. He put her on a pedestal, which is where he liked to keep his mother, who was only a few years older than Sissy, and who he had to wait until his mother died in order to be able to marry Sissy, and he married her 2 weeks later. So there was a very short, period of time when there was a kind of shift of affection and allegiance. And I don't think Chandler and Sissy had great arguments. I think they had such a civil and mannered relationship. They took tea every afternoon. They listened to the same classical gas hour radio program every night. They had these rituals, and it was really, Chandler was a very domestic guy. He loved the gentle rounds of domesticity, shopping, cooking, making meals together, being with Sissy. And here he's created this archetypal bachelor. But if you really look at Marlowe, he's one of the neatest, tidiest guys, constantly emptying ashtrays and teaching a cop how to make coffee and, tearing the bed apart in a woman.
Vacuuming the floor.
He is, in many ways, Chandler felt that they shared a lot in common.
There is the thought that when Chandler went to work at Paramount, that may have disrupted the marriage in some way, because suddenly he saw the way that other screenwriters were, marrying or being with people 20 years younger than they, as opposed to him, who was married to somebody 20 years his senior, that this made him start looking at Sissy in a different light. And there's the question of, I guess it was the night that they screened the Double Indemnity, where he sort of snuck out. And Wilder thought that was because he was ashamed of her. But then the other thought is that he just didn't want to talk to Wilder. I mean, that's sort of my interpretation of that. I think Wilder always disliked Chandler to begin with.
And Chandler disliked Wilder.
Yeah, I think a lot of it was anti-Semitic, actually.
Could be.
I mean, I just think they didn't get along, and Wilder has this sour approach toward Chandler about everything.
Well, and you read that interview with Wilder. As long as Sissy and Chandler led this great course of life, just the two of them, he didn't drink, he didn't have a thirst. But you let him out into the world as, all the during the 30s when he's writing his first stories, he's not drinking. It's just the two of them. He looks quite happy in photographs. Then he gets this call to Hollywood and work on Double Indemnity. And he has to work on the lot of Paramount. And there are all of those lusciously beautiful young women, not just actresses,
secretaries.
And he's so tempted. Not only that, they start drinking at like, 10 in the morning. The writer's building. He begins drinking again, and he begins womanizing again. He's had affairs in the 20s when he worked for Dabney Oil, and he's been completely sober, bonded with Sissy. Now he's back out in the world. He's drinking again, and he begins having affairs. And yes, you've got a guy like Wilder, who at the time I think was only in his mid-30s, but he's showing up at the premiere of Double Indemnity with a 17-year-old starlet on his arm. But nobody thinks that's strange. Nobody thinks that's odd, that Wilder is with a woman who's probably young enough to be his daughter. But that Raymond Chandler, who's then maybe 53, and Sissy is 70, has turned up at this premiere. And then Wilder says they sneak out before it's over. And the interviewer says, why? And he says, because he doesn't want to be seen with his wife. And the interviewer says, why? And he says, because she's a gray-haired old lady. And the interviewer says, you mean to say she's a mother figure? And Wilder says, no, she's a mother image. And when I first read that, I thought, he doesn't understand that at that point also Chandler may have just been very protective of Sissy. He may not have wanted her to be subjected to, that kind of scrutiny. Yes, they may have snuck out of it. He may have not wanted to see Wilder. He didn't like him. But the other thing is, maybe he wasn't there. But the one thing that makes me suspect about what Wilder said was, he said a gray-haired old lady. Sissy would not have been caught dead, literally, with gray hair. She was a bottle blonde to the end of her life. She was a very attractive woman. Houseman, when he used to go for Sunday drives with him during this period, and he said they made a very odd couple because his wife looked 20 years older. But Chandler had had a hard life. He looked 10 years older than he was. His wife looked 20 years older than he did and dressed 30 years younger. So they were kind of an odd couple. She dressed in very frilly clothes. She didn't change her hairstyle from 1912 when he met her. She was an exceedingly beautiful woman. And you see this even in the picture of her when she's 82. But there are photographs in my book when she's young. And she's just not as beautiful. She's so lovely.
Well, she did a lot of nude modeling, too, when she was younger.
She was wild. She, in the 1890s, she moved from Ohio to Harlem when it was still a white community. And she became part of this high-life bohemian set that used to occasionally do opium. And she posed nude for artists and photographers. This was an unheard-of thing to do in the 1890s. She was a libertine, in part. And she got married. I found her marriage certificate during that time to a traveling salesman. Even then, she was lying about her age. She was 27, and she listed her age as 23. When she married Chandler, she was 53. He was 35. On the marriage certificate, she put 43. On her death certificate, somehow, she managed to lie. She was 84, and when I found the death certificate with the body and Bobby, and she's listed as 68. That was Chandler. By then, they'd become very complicit in the fiction about her life, very sensitive about her age. So, yes, that nude modeling, he was said to have owned pictures of her from that period. I have a picture in my book of her modeling draped in this kind of Parisian gown, but she got married again after the traveling salesman. She divorced him and married a composer and pianist who was English from the West Indies. They came to L.A. in 1910, something like that. And that, and when Chandler met her, she was still married, and he wooed her away from that husband. He was so in love with her. She was said to be witty and high-spirited, very funny, very natural. He said, so attractive, but without any awareness of it, really, not using it. So Chandler was her third husband. She was a very worldly woman. She was also kind of, by then, affecting a more upper-class, almost English accent. When she married Chandler, She pronounced her name Chandler. So she was this interesting combination of libertine and lady. And I think when you look at The Big Sleep and many of his other plots, where nude photographs come in as part of the blackmail, or a young bad seed girl like Carmen Sternwood taking drugs and then being blackmailed for nude photographs that have been taken of her, I think that I can see Sissy there, that the nude photographs of Sissy and Sissy's own background, you know, is quite exotic. But I feel like she had a part to play in the development of those ideas.
Sounds like the opening to sure. Let's do some Q&A. Any questions?
My sense is that she didn't like this young.
No, I think he did. I think he did. I think that he always wanted to also become a literary writer. And any efforts in that direction were really a failure. But I think in the end he felt that there was a real camaraderie and honesty among mystery writers, and that literary writers were so pretentious. And he said in the beginning of his book they were really embraced by the English as literary novels. And in America, Big Sleep got really not such great reviews when it came out. It was looked at as a study of depravity, filled with moral defects. And he said, after a couple of books, in England, I'm considered an author. Here, I'm just simply a hack. I can't tell you why. So he realized very early on that some people, like Camus and Auden, I mean, very literary people, were looking at him and saying, this is a literary writer. He's elevated the mystery into the realm of literature. It took much longer for us to get it here. And I think by the end of his life, he'd made a list of all the things he wanted to do, which was to write literary novels. But he more or less said in his notebook, I haven't done this, but I've done it in another way. And I've gotten to where, you know, I want to be. So he felt very happy about how his books had been received finally. And I think he knew at the end of his life that he created something quite enduring. He said that only he and Marilyn Monroe had managed to reach all the brows, high brow, low brow, and middle brow.
He was very happy to have gotten the acclaim from the Mystery Writers of America near the end of his life. He was a grandmaster.
Just 2 weeks before he died, he went to New York to give a talk to the Mystery Writers. And it was the moment at which his fortunes might have changed, and they didn't. But he was, you know, it was just as though he was talking about the love in his heart. To be there in front of this group. So I think he had a lot of affection.
How do you account for that reclusive aspect of his personality? I mean, the period in the 30s before he went to Hollywood, when him and Sissy were living in sort of low rent districts around Los Angeles. In fiction, Marlowe is a lonely character, but I mean, he's somewhat sophisticated, and Marlowe interacting with a lot of people in those stories. How do you account for that reclusiveness that they
lived in? Well, I think it was Sissy's age in part. By then her age was really beginning to show. I also think that he'd gone through a terrible period. He'd fallen so hard in 1932 when he got fired from Dabney Oil for drinking and womanizing. He'd betrayed Sissy. He'd become as big a louse as his father, who left the family when Chandler was 7, and he never saw his father again. He was a lousy alcoholic and womanizer. And I think Chandler in 1932, when Sissy took him back and he stopped drinking, that the way he kept himself together was to have this solitary life with her. And that if they didn't go out too much, that not only would her age not, you know, become but it was an embarrassment or an issue, or they had quite a wonderful life, just the two of them together. So I think it was those two things. I think it had to do with drinking and keeping a very quiet life. It helped him stay grounded and helped him transform himself from an accountant into a writer. And then I think also the fact that she was becoming, it wasn't just that she was aging, she was becoming more fragile, she had a lung condition. So I don't know, but I think those two things.
They did have friends earlier on. I mean, he was part of that group, the
Fictioneers.
Which I thought would be a great name for a group now. Fictioneers.
Yes. And he loved them. He thought that, you know, but he was very quiet when he'd go to their meeting. And occasionally, yes, this was when he was first writing for Black Mass, he insists he would go to one of their houses to a dinner. But they reported that he didn't drink. He would drink coffee and sit around, and they wouldn't say much. And at one gathering, he found out that the hostess's cat had been banished to a trailer out back during the party, and he went out to the trailer to comfort the cat. And the hostess said that he seemed so much more interested in spending the evening in the trailer with the cat than the people. So it's not true that they never went out, but it became less.
But they also went out to Earl Stanley Gardner's place.
They loved Earl Stanley Gardner because he had a lunar telescope. And Sissy was also a lunar telescope enthusiast. They said so they would go out and look at the moon and spend the night down at Earl Stanley Gardner's house. They did have some. You know, and the odd thing is that James M. Cain said when Chandler arrived in Hollywood with Sissy, James M. Cain at one point calls them Hollywood's happiest couple. So they must have, you know, gone out a bit. He was in La Jolla. Yeah.
How did they put themselves through all that movement? Did they keep up the story so it was a relatively easy thing?
They rented furnished apartments. Sissy, when she left her husband, Julian, for Chandler in 1920, put her stuff in storage, and he rented an apartment for her. She must have had some stuff then. And he and his mother lived together for four more years until his mother died, and then he married Sissy. But I think when they became, you know, they had a big Packard convertible. You could put boxes of books and a typewriter and some kitchen stuff.
Do you have like a favorite guest?
You don't hear them talking at all about furniture. It was so possible to rent a furnished apartment
right. In
L.A. and it was so cheap. And I don't think that belongings really mattered much to them at all. I think that their sense of location came from each other, not from one place filled up with a bunch of stuff. And it isn't until he starts working in Hollywood and they live on Drexel Avenue in the Fairfax area that they start going to antique shops and they start living a little bit better, more like Hollywood people do. And then in 1946, he's just so sick of LA. He just says it's turned into a tired old whore for him. And they move to La Jolla and they buy a house on Camino de la Costa. And that's where they lived for 8 years until she dies. And then he sells the house. It doesn't mean anything to him. And he becomes, once again, back and forth between London and La Jolla.
When you were visiting, when you were looking for all these different houses that they lived in, did you ever get to one of the houses and go, oh my God, that's the house in London?
No, I never did. There was one apartment that's just a lovely apartment that they lived in 1932 called the El Pueblo apartment on Greenwood, just off of Vermont, just south of Los Feliz. And when I did look at that, I thought, wow, it looks so familiar. It's such a beautiful apartment. It's so graceful. It's one of the Spanish revival. And then someone later told me that was used in the opening shot of Melrose Place. Over and over again. Even though I'm not, you know, a big fan of Melrose Place, I must have said, oh, looks familiar. But about 50% of the places where I went, the original houses or apartments were gone, which gave me a sense of how quickly things turn over in L.A. And most of them were not charming, lovely places. They were really ordinary little bungalow courts. They were kind of dreadful little houses. Even in Pacific Palisades, on one street that he lived on, now all the houses have been enlarged and they're quite lovely and, you know, it's a very nice neighborhood, except for this ratty, ugly little house. It hasn't changed at all. And that was where the Chandlers lived.
So, just kind of throwing this out here to see what you think of your research, but yeah, one thing to Philip Marlowe being the white knight, he's chaste, usually, you know, younger women put themselves at him, and he's kind of like Teflon, you know. Although I think it's the long kiss goodnight, he finally has sex with a lady that's about his age, maybe even older. Was that, did you see any parallels there?
That was actually his first sleepover in 6 books.
Yeah.
Linda Loring. And it's interesting that she's a brunette.
Yeah.
And that the women who've mostly attracted Marlowe in the other novels are those brassy, deadly blondes. And but the truth is, Marlowe's really unavailable to women. He gives them a good hard kiss now and then, and usually their lips are pretty icy. And you know, he has to go through, it almost seems like a kind of obligatory thing with women. But the other interesting point is that the women he's most attracted to end up being the most brutal killers. That in 6 out of the 7 novels, it's a woman who commits the murder. And it's usually the murderer. It's usually the woman Marlowe's most attracted to. But attracted meaning just in this kind of very superficial, almost obligatory way. But with Linda Loring, in The Long Goodbye, the first time he meets her, she's having a gimlet, and it's the drink that his really good friend, Terry Lennox, drinks. And it's as though some of the power of that friendship with Terry Lennox, which is the real love affair in the book, is the real deep, deep friendship. Marlowe was very, very, you know, bonded to Terry Lennox. So much so that when he betrays him at the end of the book, it's just, you know, like shattering. But so Linda Loring kind of gets some of that male bonding friendship through that drink. And then, you know, she doesn't quite fit the pattern of the blonde, like Eileen Wade in that book. And in the end, yes, she's also a multimillionaire. And Chandler wrote The Long Goodbye as his wife was dying. He said, I wrote my best book as my wife lay dying, not by inches, but by half inches. So he's like, I think psychologically, as he knows that he's having to let go of Sissy, this great love of his life, he's trying to give Marlowe something. He said he thought it was time that Marlowe had something of his own, some woman. So he has Linda Loring, you know, kind of proposed to him. Not really, I don't think she proposes in that book.
No, it's the next one. And somewhere there were birds singing.
Yes.
Whatever it is.
It's so romantic.
Yeah.
It's just, he was such a romantic guy.
No, in that book she leaves him, and he says that the French have a saying for it, to say goodbye is to die a little. Those bastards have a saying for everything.
I think on that note, hopefully both of you can hang out for a few minutes, and Judith's book is now available in trade paperback. So please, you know, come and she can sign it for you. I wanted to also tell you the reason why we have the program here in this particular restaurant. like Little Tokyo's my backyard. You know, I don't know the valley. Many of you guys know the valley, but this is my place. So, but a scene from Farewell My Lovely with Robert Mitchum was actually filmed here. And it's when Moose is, you know, I think there's a line like, a shadow fell over my chop suey or something. And it was probably filmed right around here. So that's another reason why we decided to have it. Yes.
And I just wanted to mention that on Wednesday night, I'm going to do a panel with Kenny Turan, the film critic, and Leo Brody, the cultural critic, and Denise Hamilton, the mystery writer at USC, in Intellectual Commons, which is in the faculty dining area. That's at 7:30. It's called Something More Than Night. And we really want to talk about Chandler's legacy and sort of, again, celebrate the fact that this is the week 50 years ago that he died. Thank you. Something More Than Night, Wednesday night, the 25th at 7:30 at USC.
And before you all leave, I want to take a group photo. I'm going up there, so I need to stand up and, I don't know, maybe stand behind between Rosemary and Dale. And I could take a group picture.
Thank you. I thought I turned it off.